Art. Welcome to this lecture on virtual machines. So, yesterday, we kind of finished the overall overview over the implementation of Prolog, and now started to look at various kinds of optimizations and extensions. And so one very important optimization which we saw yesterday already was this last call thing. So the idea of this last call optimization was to reuse the current stack frame for the evaluation of the last literal whenever possible. So if that is, we saw that there might be situations where this is not possible because there are backtrack points on this on top of the stack, and then this we can check by a simple by comparing the current backtrack pointer with the frame pointer. So that was one thing, but in certain situations, such as for example for the append function, for the append predicate, we were able to we observe that we always can evaluate the recursive call to the up predicate within the same stack frame. So now the next optimization, and which is almost equally important, is this clause indexing thing. So currently the mechanism we have implemented for each predicate is that we sequentially try one clause after the other. This might be, if there are many clauses, this is quite time consuming. So our next idea is now that we are a little bit more, that we do a little bit of inspection of the actual parameters of the current literal, and try to, from these, to extract information whether only to restrict the set of possible alternatives to a small subset. And we could do that in general, but we will not do it in general, but only will do it in a very restricted way by just looking at the first argument. And so then we make a case distinction. Well, the first argument, what could it be? So either it is an unbound variable, so then we know nothing. So every alternative is still possible. But if the first argument, say, starts with a particular constructor, then we kind of can restrict the set of possible clauses which are still applicable to those where the first argument matches the situation. And that means, since we kind of directly exclude a lot of clauses, we detect earlier whether the whole application fails, and we can remove backtrack points earlier. You have to keep a backtrack point when there are still open alternatives, but if we have excluded most of the other alternatives, we can give up the backtrack point quickly. And that means that stack frames can be earlier popped, and everything gets more deterministic and more efficient. So let us look at this particular example, our favorite example here. So what do we see? So here, okay, so here are the heads. According to our convention, heads only contain variables. So by that, we cannot, so whether in the call, the x is the first argument, so that is the thing which we will inspect. But then we realize that here afterwards, the next literal at the beginning of the body, there is a unification goal which provides. Restrictions on the first argument. So in the first clause, this is only possible, this will only succeed if x equals an empty list, and the second clause will only succeed if x is a non-empty list. Okay? That is, we conclude if we observe the actual parameter x, and if we find that at one time the root constructor is the empty list, then only the first clause applies. This means the thing is completely deterministic. There's no backtracking at all. Likewise, if the top constructor at runtime of the first argument is a non-empty list, then we know only the second clause can applies and nothing else. So again, no backtrack point. Yeah? And if there is another constructor at the first, if X is bound at runtime with something which is different from an empty or non-empty list, then we definitely know that the whole thing will fail. Yeah? And there is one case when backtracking really is needed, and this is when the first argument is an unbound variable. Because in that case, we do not know whether the first or the second clause will apply. Yeah? So this accordingly, now our idea is the following. We change the code for a predicate in such a way that we first inspect the root constructor of the first argument. And then, for each possible root constructor, we introduce a separate try chain, which only lists those clauses which match this root constructor. And also, clearly, for the variable case, we still will have the full list. But for a non-variable case, we will have a sub list, and hopefully a one-element list. And if it's a one-element list, then we directly jump to this alternative, and there is no backtracking at all. Yeah? So once again, so we introduce a separate try chain for every possible constructor. Then in the code, we will inspect the first argument, and depending on the result, we then will perform an indexed jump to the appropriate try chain. Yeah, so again, so note there is this index jumping according to the top constructor. So really this corresponds to a switch in C. Yeah. So, but for that we need kind of a pre-processing which takes the M clauses and kind of extracts the chains. For the different root constructors. So let us see. Yeah. Let us see. I think, so I will not explain to you in a formal way how these try chains all will be constructed, but we just look at our favorite example, this app predicate. So the app predicate, so we had in overall, we had two clauses, and now we have to consider separate try chains for the variable case. So this means when at runtime we find that the test of the root constructor will find that this is the root constructor is not known because the first argument is an unbound variable. In this case, this is the var case. And now this is the chain for which corresponds to this var case, and this you notice, this is exactly the try chain which we have already constructed so far. So that is, the try chain which we had so far will still always be available, or will be necessary always, because it corresponds to this variable case. Now, there are three more chains. One, when the top constructor is the empty list. One, when it is this list constructor, or when it is a constructor which is different from all these. And we see in this nil and in the cons case, things are very easy. All this try chaining collapses to a jump. In these cases, we directly jump to the corresponding alternatives, and this is great, yeah? Because this means that there is no backtrack point installed in these cases. And you also see When we did this last call optimization, and sometimes it was kind of helpful when we know that this clause was the last one in the try chain. Now here we see that the same clause could be a last clause or a non-last clause in different, since because there are several try chains. Only this A2 here, the clause, the second clause, this will be always the last clause in a try chain. Yeah? But that is not the case for this clause here, which is the last clause here in this nil case, but it is a non-last clause in the full case. Yeah? So in that sense, there is, okay. So that is kind of, now we have the try chains, and you see, I hope you kind of understand the principle, intuitively the principle how these try chains are constructed. In particular, if you have an extra clause, so for example a last clause without where there's no no unification with the first argument, so that is the first argument is not checked. If this is the case, then this kind of clause will occur in all try chains. So in that sense, it is not necessarily the case that try chains contain only single elements. They could also contain multiple elements. But I would say a skilled Prolog programmer will try to organize his code in such a way that mostly, or in all expected cases, like here in the nil and in the const case, so these are the expected uses of the up predicate, then that in these cases there is no backtracking. And then the Prolog compiler will be able, following the scheme, will be able to avoid the backtracking completely and thus generate code with this, which is equally efficient as functional code, and in case we have this last call optimization, even equally efficient as C code. Yeah. So then there was one more thing which I did kind of skipped over, but which is important here, the else case. In the else case, then each of the clauses will fail because there is always a unification with the first argument, and if the first argument starts with A, any constructor A, then which is different from the list constructors, then clearly unification will fail. Okay, so in order to deal with this case, we introduce a new instruction, this fail instruction, which immediately triggers backtracking. Okay, so now we have an idea what these try chains are. So the code for a predicate now looks as follows. We have again the code for the individual clauses. This we have somewhere. Then before that, we have this clause, this code for the try chains. Now, in order to kind of glue all these things together, we additionally need an extra piece of code, which is this one on top, which kind of accesses the first actual parameter, accesses the root node of that parameter, and then jumps to the right try chain, and this is done in the following way. This put ref one kind of pushes a reference to the first argument, okay, that we know. Then this get node is a new instruction. A get node takes a reference on top of the stack and will kind of try to access the root constructor. And then this indexing is also new. This kind of looks up does the mapping from the root constructor to the corresponding address of the try chain. Okay, so here is this get node thing. So the get node applied to a reference to a struct will kind of replace the reference by the name of the constructor. The same for an atom, and the, in case of an unbound variable, it, well, somehow we have to record that on the kind of provide the information on top of the stack that there is an that there has been seen an unbound variable. One could do it in any way. Here I simply use it, do it in such a way that I mark the particular symbol R on top of, I write that into the R like reference into this, the top stack cell. And please note that since all constructors and atoms start with small caps letters, this big, this capital R will be definitely different. Okay, so this is this get node thing. Then there's only one more, this indexing. So now here's the indexing. This is how do we implement it? So on top of the stack, we find the name of a constructor, an atom, or this special symbol R. And we have to map it to the start address of the right tri-chain. How can we do this mapping? Okay, so in particular, this mapping depends on the predicate, which we have under consideration. Therefore, this indexing has this extra argument P, K. Yeah. Now, and how can we do this mapping? And here is how we do it. We call a runtime function map, which does this mapping. And now you may ask me, oh, this is cheating. How do I implement this map? Any suggestions how I can implement this map? So I need kind of to realize any such finite map. And so I suggest to build up just a hash table. Yeah? Just a hash table, and that's good enough. That allows you to, and perhaps you have a separate hash table for each predicate P slash K, but you could also use just a joint hash table where you use the pair PK, A as a key. So it's up to you and up to your taste, up to the, how to do it. Yeah? Typically this hash table will not be the bottleneck. Because even if it is not perfect hashing and you kind of have a kind of collision and then you try two, three things, this is still much cheaper than kind of iterating through all the clauses. Okay. So that was already this optimization, and you saw it was not so complicated. And the key issue is that we split, that we additionally provide, additionally to the kind of tri-chain for all clauses, we additionally provide sub-chains for these individual constructors and use this indexing thing, an indexing jump to the right tri-chain. That's the key idea, and it's simple enough. But nonetheless, extremely useful. Okay, so now let us see. We have now really covered quite significant parts of real Prolog. Let us now go a little bit more into the direction of real Prolog. And that is the next observation which practical Prolog programmers have observed is that without the cut you can't do anything practical. The cut is in some sense a completely dubious thing because it destroys the kind of foundation of or the grounding of the programming language in logic. Without the cut you have something you can't say. This is implemented logic in some sense because you have these inference rules, and when you derive something, there is you can argue with proofs, and you have proven facts, and that's so. In that sense, it's very nice and theoretically pleasing. There's a minor obstacle, and that is that in most cases the things will not terminate simply. Because you make a depth-first search, you kind of when you want to prove a literal, you go to, you choose the first clause, then you descend into proving the first literal in this in the body, and so on. And this is depth first proof search. And depth first proof search might not terminate. There might be a proof, but it might not be reachable by means of depth first search. So in this sense, the logical foundation is already shaken by this non-termination issue. But without that, at least in principle, this is logic, and that was one of the reasons why people kind of were enthusiastic about Prolog in the early days. Now there comes another thing, and then that Prolog is not just logic, but it's also kind of, since it is non-deterministic language, you are searching for a proof for a fact. So it's a search problem. And then you have a search space which you have to traverse. And somehow you, without any extra help, the search space might have certain areas which are not so nice because they are infinite or so. So you want to direct your search. And the cut operator is one of these things by which you kind of can prune parts of the search space and direct your search in particular directions. So who has an idea about the cut operator? Everybody of you, or someone has not? Who has not yet? So I will explain it in a minute. Who has not a clear idea about the cut operator? Aha, okay. So here is the idea of the cut. So perhaps, here. So here, assume that you want to kind of implement something like an if-then-else. Yeah? So this would be this example. So the idea is the first clause is the then part, and the second clause is the else part. And it seems natural to us that one would kind of implement it in this way. So this means, if this literal, the condition holds, then this is executed, okay? And if the condition not holds, then this should be executed. Yeah? So this is the idea. But this is not what in Prolog happens. Why? So, because, assume for a moment that this here has, so this bang, please ignore it for a moment. So what happens is, you execute this this predicate, it succeeds, so you are really in the then part, and then you execute this Q1. Now the Q1 fails. What will happen? Okay, so Prolog, in the pure sense, will try, okay, Q1 fails, because I perhaps picked the wrong proof for P. So I try to reprove P. And then it tries to reprove P. But that's somehow a bit stupid, because this was the condition I just wanted to check, and I do not want to check it again, because I'm now the condition holds, full stop. So I'm sure the condition holds. Please do not touch the P of X again. So this I want to kind of communicate to Prolog. And without, in the pure Prolog world, I do not have the possibility to do so. But now comes this cut thing. The cut thing says, okay, I did the proof for P of X, so now this is fixed. Do not question this P of X anymore. So this means if the Q1 of X, Y fails later, then this means the whole clause has failed. Yeah? So you understand the problem? So technically this means when this fails, I do not go back to reproving P, but I say, okay, so that was the whole clause is gone. I have to find another clause, another proof for branch. This means simply I give up all the backtrack points in here. These I give up and go back to the backtrack points in the branch. Okay. Go back to the backtrack point to the backtrack point branch, and there is, and they go on to the next alternative there. Okay, So this, technically this means once the query before the cut have succeeded, then the choice is in this clause is committed, and backtracking will only recur to the backtrack points preceding the call to the left-hand side. Preceding the call to the left-hand side, and So this means we store inside here we have there is a backtrack, the current backtrack, the old backtrack pointer. So this is in the So this is the stack. I have the stack frame. When I start when I'm in the evaluation of the right hand side, I evaluate inside a stack frame for the branch. So this is the current stack frame. And now, what I do is, in between the backtrack pointer at this point, the current backtrack pointer may have deviated from the backtrack pointer, the old one, which is inside there. And then we restore that. Yeah? We restore So the current backtrack pointer is something, and we restore the backtrack pointer which has been stored inside the branch. That is what we do. And furthermore, all the stack frames on top of it, and going back here, so we have this the stack frame for the branch, and then the evaluation of P has put a lot of further stack frames on top of it. Now comes the cut, and this means we can kind of cancel all these things here, throw them away, because we will not return to them. All the backtrack points there will not be accessed anymore, so therefore we can pop them. So in this sense, this cutting thing has a tremendous impact on the space consumption, because we can pop a lot of stack frames. So we pop all of them and return to that stack frame which corresponds to branch, because that is the stack frame which we need anyway, because this is the current stack frame where the local variables, the X and the Y, live in. Okay? So we pop all the, that, we pop all the stack, sorry, we pop all stack frames on top of the local variables. So this is the idea, and that we do in such a way, we translate the cut into a sequence of two instructions, one which we know and one which is new. So the one which is we know is this one, this push env m. This does not mean that we push something, but this means that we set the stack pointer in distance m of the frame pointer. Okay, if M is the number of local variables, this means exactly we put the stack pointer down there and have thrown away, blown away all the stack frames on top of it. Yeah, so we just return to the stack frame, and this pruning thing, this is the instruction which will restore the old backtrack pointer. So that in our example, if we have now this piece of this predicate, then the try chain will look as follows. So the try chain is here: set backtrack point, try A, delete backtrack point, jump B, and A and B are the two alternatives. Now the alternative A. So what do we have to do there? So for A. This is the clause containing our fabulous cut. So it means that we first have to implement the P of X. The first thing which we have to do is kind of pushing. So we have two variables. So we have this push and two. Then now we comes the implementation of P of X. So we mark off a stack frame. Then we put the X. X is a initialized variable, therefore put ref 1, and then we call the predicate P1. Okay, so that's it. And now comes the cut, and as we said, now this is just pruning and re-establishing that the stack pointer has distance 2 to the frame pointer. So it's very short, and now we have implemented the cut. And now comes the Q1 of X, Y. This is now the last. This piece of code. And first we do this. It's the last literal. Therefore, last mark. Then putting the two actual parameters. So it's a putref1 and a putref2. Because both of them are initialized. And then we do this last calling. Note that in this particular case, due to the cut, we know that there is no backtrack point on top of the stack. So in fact, this last marking could be abandoned, and the last call can be made. The last call can be made a jump. Yeah, the last call can be made a jump. Okay, so that's because there's no backtrack point on top of. Is it so? Well, I'm not completely sure. No, it's not. The last is made a jump. Okay. But I'm a little bit. A little bit confused because. Yes. So I will not return to the. Yeah, that's true. So like the last call can be made. Replaced by making a move and then a jump. And now for the second clause. The second clause is also a last clause, and we kind of put the environment, push the environment again, and afterwards, we kind of. Since it's the last call and there's no backtrack point on top of it, so we can put the arguments and then replace the call by moving the call followed by the popenv. We can replace it by moving and jumping. So in this sense, this cutting helps to make the code. It helps also the last call optimization, in this case at least. Okay? And I think there is, in modern Prolog dialects, they have a kind of built-in predicate, like an if-then-else thing, or which is, behaves like an if-then-else, and you can understand it as being implemented in this way. Okay, now what is the pruning? So the pruning says that we will not return to the current, so that we go to the for the old BPP. So the current backtrack pointer, the current backtrack point will be the old backtrack point. So that's all what pruning will do. Yeah. So we take what we have as an old BPP, old backtrack point in the stack, in the current stack frame, and we'll push it into and we'll put it into, write it into the, copy it into the register BP. Okay, so that's one thing, and there's only this thing is not completely correct in all cases, because here we assume somehow that we have a stack frame, that the current, that the clause where the cut occurs is within a predicate which for which we have installed a backtrack point. So that is, there is a stack frame and the BP old has been recorded. So for the term, in case that the, we have a single clause, a predicate is implemented by a single clause, we will not necessarily initialize the backtrack point, which means we will not necessarily store the old backtrack pointer. Yeah, so if a clause is single, then we have not stored the old backtrack point inside the stack frame, and then this is kind of problematic. So in that sense, in this case, we have to kind of do something more. So in this case, we kind of introduce a new instruction, which we call set cut, which we only insert for these single clause predicates when in this single clause there is a cut, the cut symbol. That we can syntactically check. If this is the case, we kind of do insert this set cut instruction before the clausal code or before the jump to the clausal code in order to set the backtrack point. And that is for the single clause predicates, and it's also it might be that we have a predicate which is implemented by multiple clauses, but by this we have, when we do this tri-chaining for the clause indexing, there might be cases when we have when the tri-chain is of length 1. And then this all the complete tri-chain only consists of jumping to the alternative. And this is, and then this jumping to the alternative will not initialize this backtrack point. Therefore, in this case, we set the cut before. And the setting of the cut does nothing else but storing the old backtrack pointer in the, in the stack frame. Okay? So that means, yeah. So then, this was kind of the, yeah, that was this one, and now we only have, it might be worthwhile to look at one further important feature of Prolog, which is negation by which is negation. So it's kind of an application which people usually implement by means of which we now can implement by means of the cut, and which was not possible before. So one of the problems of this pure Prolog thing is where we kind of define things by rules. So what happens if we want to say that not effect holds, but we want to say effect does not hold? How can we deal with negative information? And in fact, it turns out this pure Prolog thing cannot deal appropriately with negative information. And this is makes the again, this is kind of a problem for the logical or the logical interpretation of Prolog has problems with that. So, but we can kind of provide something which is a kind of substitute for negation. And this is negation by failure. we can say that not P holds if our attempt to prove P fails. Okay? So now the clearly, well, on the other hand, so that means we have to kind of continue after a failure. This is not so easy. So, but with the cut it is possible. So here is the way how we can do it. So if assume that we have a predicate P, and we want not P should succeed whenever all our attempts to prove P have failed. How can we do it? Okay, we do it in this way, as indicated here. We first try to prove P, then we make this bang thing, the cut, and then afterwards fail. This means, as soon as P succeeds to, as soon as P has succeeded, we fail, and then we go back to the, so then we do not try the other alternative of not P, because this is ridiculous, because the other alternative will always succeed, but we go back to the, back, the whole predicate has failed, and then that means we go back to the vector current before. Yeah? And in case that the, that we do, did not succeed to prove P, then the first we do not never reach the cut, and therefore we immediately go to the second alternative, which immediately succeeds. Yeah. So in that sense, this is the implementation of not P, at least under the assumption that P can be proven by a finite proof. So if P the proof, if trying the if the search space of proofs for P is infinite, then this is bad. Using this kind of thing is a bad idea. So we will never reach the second clause. Okay? Could you understand, in particular those of you who have not so much experience with the cut, understand that this kind of definition of negation by failure? So, speaking aside, in prologue, negation by failure is done, perhaps implemented, probably implemented in this way, but provided to the user in form of a kind of meta-predicate. So you have this meta-predicate not, and then you can write, I think you can write not P of X. Yeah? So this is in some sense weird, because the P of X is a term, but a term which is interpreted as a predicate. And so in this sense, it's a meta-predicate, this not thing. But here we, in our in this lecture, we have not kind of wondered how one implements meta-predicates, and we will not consider that. Yeah? Okay, so but this negation by failure we can implement now since we have the cut. The only thing which we do not have is this fail thing. But the fail thing is very easy to implement. The goal fail is implemented by fail, because we have this instruction fail which always will be fail. Yeah. So now how do we do implement this not P? Here is the try chain for it. So we set the backtrack point. We try A, the first alternative, then we delete the backtrack point, and then we jump to B. Now A, what is that is the interesting thing, the code for A, for the first alternative. So there is only one variable, so therefore it's a push env 1. Then we have this literal P of X, so this is implemented by this sequence. We mark the stack frame, then we put the argument, which is just by put ref 1, and then we call P1. Then comes the cut, which is prune and push env 1, and then comes the implementation of fail, which is just fail. And then we are done with it, and then comes this pop env, and you see here, clearly, we could kind of, this pop env is no longer needed because we will never reach it, because there is this fail before. And then the second alternative for not P is there is no push env 1 because there is no push env 1 because there is only one local variable, and then immediately pop env because it is the body is empty. This will always succeed. Okay? Is there a question? Okay, so that in some sense now we are completely done with the Prolog implementation. We should use this opportunity for a moment to wonder how to wonder a little bit about garbage collection, because now we have seen three languages, one without garbage, completely without garbage collection, namely C. So everything is in your responsibility. And I don't know who has ever implemented a dynamic data structure in C, or a larger application with dynamic data structures in C. What did you do to do the garbage collection? You inserted three statements into your code to get rid of the garbage. You did the same, and this worked, or did you have a lot of problems by getting the three statements right? You needed a lot of what? So you had several attempts until you got it right. What kind of data structure you implemented? So probably it's not your daily enjoying pastime exercise to do so. Yeah. So it's not so easy. And so because in some sense we are. We are spoiled by Java and similar garbage collecting languages that they do the job for us. And so we might take a brief, make a kind of a break here and kind of try to understand how languages such as Java, OCaml, or Prolog, how they do this garbage collection thing. I will not show you the kind of the cutting edge garbage collection algorithms. So there's quite some research in these how to construct a decent garbage collector, and to a certain sense the efficiency of a programming language such as OCaml heavily depends on having a very efficient garbage collector. So here I only try to explain to you the principles, and in particular the differences between garbage collection for the MAMA and the garbage collection for Vim programs. Because it turns out that it's not the same garbage collection algorithms which you would like to apply for both. The obvious idea is that objects that can no longer be reached by means of references are collected. And the garbage collection for C has problems because there is no clear concept of a reference. There's only the concept of an address, but an address is the same as a number in some sense. And you can add addresses, and that is, even if you have no direct pointer to an object, you still might be able to reach the object simply by taking a pointer and adding 5. So in that sense, just only because you do not point directly to something, this does not mean that you cannot reach it. So in this sense, it is difficult to do an automatic garbage collection for things like C, at least as long as you have this address arithmetic, and in particular type casts. Okay, so that makes it difficult there. But in the functional languages, you do not have explicit address arithmetic. You only have the references, and therefore there you have the clear opportunity. And I see whether in the code and also in the implementation whether something is a number or a pointer, and therefore you can kind of do such a thing like garbage collection. Okay, now. It is also a little bit subtle when one says an object can no longer be reached. So reaching means that you have a starting point, and from there you follow a path. But what are the starting points? What are the starting points? The stack. So the stack, the memory cells on the stack, these are the starting points, and everything which is reachable from the stack, this is reachable and you have to keep it. So it's a little bit more complicated if you have things like Java. Why? Okay, you also have globals. In some sense, where do you have globals? Java has no globals. Where do you have globals?
In static.
Yes, you have the static variables. And is there something more what you have?
Classes.
You have classes, yes. In some sense, these are kind of the static things. So you can think of that a static variable lives in the class object. So this means if you have to provide the you have to keep. So in some sense, the frames or so or the data objects for the classes are also starting points. And are there more such starting points which you have to take into account? Yes, there are more such things. If you think of, if you have a kind of nice GUI, then you have kind of you see things there. You have the components there, and as when they are visible, then they are there. You cannot collect them. Also, there is no pointers to them. As long as they are visible, you cannot collect them. And there's more things. At least it comes to my mind that you have things like threads. Threads are also objects. You need not point to them, but still the thread, as long as it is running, it is there. And only if there is no pointer to the thread anymore and it's not running anymore, then you might collect it. But before that, you might not collect it, because the thread might still be accessible from the thread object from inside the run function. Because you have this, you can access it, you have this current thread thing or so, by that you can find out that you are alive. Yeah. So in this sense, there are the set of... it's not always completely obvious what the starting points are, and you have to be, when you have your garbage collector for your particular favorite language, then you should kind of make first an overview of what are the starting points. Okay? And then the other thing is, so this is again speaking aside, sorry for boring you with such aside speakings, but it's also not so completely trivial to even if you know that the references in the stack are start points for the garbage collector. You somehow now have to traverse the garbage collector has to traverse the stack, but on the stack you have all kinds of data. You have, at least we have, these organizational cells and also kind of basic values, which kind of, if you are in the middle of an evaluation of an expression, then you could also have basic values sitting on the stack. And then in some situations, and some things are also references. And so you kind of, that means also on the stack, you kind of cannot, even if you know if the runtime system for a particular stack frame knows that a certain number is an address. The question is whether the stack traversal for the garbage collector has this information, because it just looks not just from a particular frame, but it comes from, it sees just the stack. So in some sense here you have kind of a problem that you kind of, either you tag one, how to identify or how to differentiate the addresses from the values in the stack. Yeah. So once again, the runtime system, which knows the layout of the stack frame, knows what is in the stack frame. What in the stack frame is a register? What is a data value? What is a reference? So that we made clear. So we could have written all numbers onto the stack for each thing, and everything would be fine. But the garbage collector is not happy with that, because that the garbage collector somehow sees just the stack as a sequence of data. Okay, and now what is now the reference? So the garbage collector also has to be able to identify the references. So one way is kind of that one identifies references by, for example, by the first bit or the last bit, no, probably the first bit, making constants a little bit shorter. That I guess is the way in SML type languages. Sometimes it's also the case, I guess, in OCaml. So that would be one possibility to make the distinction, or you really tag the values on the stack, or the garbage collector you hop from stack frame to stack frame, and for each stack frame you have kind of a layout information, and so you have your own traversal method for your stack frame, which is sitting somewhere in the stack frame. Yeah, that means in the stack frame that you have a code pointer. And the code pointer is only called for the garbage collector. And this code pointer knows then what is a reference and what is not a reference. So this one could also do. So at least what I want to tell you by that is that even such a stupid thing like inspecting the stack and searching for the references is not as stupid as one might have guessed at first thought. So it is a complicated thing even. Oh, well, one has to kind of have a clear concept of it. Okay, so that is the thing. So we have these start points, assuming that we know where they are. And from there, everything that is reachable from there, this we must keep, and everything which is not reachable, then this is definitely garbage. So that is our idea. And that garbage we would like to reclaim, because this fills up and kind of memory is finite, and if there's only garbage in the memory, then we are doomed. So now, if for that we first observe that this in the MAMA we had no freeing, we only had allocation, and so there is. We should be able to collect. So for the Vim, the thing is a little bit different. There we had, in fact, some form of garbage collection already. And that was when we initiated backtracking. Then we popped the heap and did the unbinding. And so that was kind of a garbage collection. But that is only a garbage collection in case of failure. If it's not a garbage collection in case of success, but also in case of success, there could be garbage. Yeah, and that is not collected in this way. Okay. So now what we do is we consider how a garbage collector could work. And we think of here, we only consider one thing, which is it's a stop and copy collector. This means that during garbage collection, the program execution is interrupted, suspended, and resumed later. So this is not necessarily the case. You could also think of a garbage collector which runs concurrently to the main program. This is in particular, you might think of that if you have multiple cores which you might want to occupy. It's a little, but a collector which runs concurrently with the allocator or with the mutator, so with the ordinary program, has problems and is more complicated, because while he collects something, new things are allocated, new references are created, and it could be that there are certain intermediate states where a reference is in the process of being killed, there are intermediates, so at least they must cooperate in some form. so that there is that one does not get a complete mess. So here in this, so the most simple thing is either the program runs or the collector runs. And in that case, so one possibility of kind of squeezing out the garbage from the memory is to operate with with a subdivision of the heap into two regions, which one might call to space and from space. In the to space, there is all the currently allocated memory objects together with the garbage. And then the idea is to in the from space. So in the old in the from space, there you have all the mixture of garbage and non-garbage. And then the idea is you kind of copy the reachable memory objects into the to space. And then the garbage is then you only have meaningful data objects in the to space. Then you can throw away the complete from space. And then the program restarts or continues. The program execution resumes with where now the to space is the current space. And when the current space is full, you again start the garbage collector and copy into the other space the reachable objects. Yeah? Okay. So that is the idea. Now what happens? How do I extract the reachable memory cells from space and move them into the to space? How do I do it? So the first, there you can, one might want to identify several phases. The first phase is you mark all the reachable objects. That is, you find, so that is kind of a depth-first search which you perform. Yeah? And so it's a depth-first search, so the only problem there is that it might be that there might be loops in there might be strongly connected components in the heap, and you must kind of take care that you do not run into infinite cycles. So that is what depth first search in a graph does. You kind of have to memorize where you have already been. So, but that you can do when you mark, kind of put a mark to each reachable object, and then you can see whether an object is already marked or not. Okay, so that is one thing. By that you kind of can find all the reachable objects. Then the next step is you copy all the objects to the to space. So this is kind of each object is a kind of memory block. You copy them into the memory block. So that is a little bit. Sounds as if this would be all of the work, but it is not all of the work because. These objects contain references, and the references are addresses in the old from space. So even if you move the objects to the to space, they still point to the from space, and that you have to correct. So that is, you have to correct the references. And then, in the end, everything is correct, and then you can kind of exchange the from space from the to space. And correction of the references does not only mean the correction of the references in the to space, but also correction of the references in the stack. Okay. So the first thing, marking, that seems easy. So you detect you walk along, you do graph reachability, the only thing there is you have to identify the references. When you succeed with that, then everything is fine. Given that you implement graph reachability, there's a minor point with that graph reachability is a recursive algorithm, and typically you can do it by a recursive function, or you can do it by means of iterative function, but then you have to maintain the stack. But that means in both cases that you have to maintain the data structure. And so if you have exhausted your memory, then you have perhaps no space anymore for your data structure. So in that sense, the question is, how do you organize that? So this is one of these particular points of a garbage collector. So one possibility which one might dream of is that one does this graph reachability thing by using the two space, because this is still empty, and install the stack there, just for the graph reachability. Okay, so now here is our a little example. Here I have four objects and a few references, so with names A, B, C, D, and references. And this reference comes from the stack. So this is kind of a source. And then you kind of follow the references. So you first mark A, then you traverse, you find that C is also a reference. That C is also reachable, and then you find that D is reachable, and then you find from D you again can follow the reference and again have a second reach the object C for a second time, but that would not make it more alive. So there is no, either something is alive or not. Okay, and B is not reachable. Okay, now comes the copying. Okay, that is in principle. So this is a conceptually separate phase. It's because conceptually separate because you could either do the marking and then again traverse the same things and copy them into the other space, or you could kind of, as soon as you reach them, copy them. Yeah, so you could kind of do the copying together with the marking. Yeah, the only thing is you have to. Yeah, so in that sense, copying the live objects in the two space, that we could do during the marking, and it's in some, because it's again, it's somehow the same. You can do it with the same DFS through the references. You could, here we expect from the, since the references inside the copied object are not, do not go to the, in the right direction, we might modify the copying in such a way that we do not just copy the object, but at the same time, at the old place, we record that the object was there and has already been moved, and the address where the copy is. So that means, so in some sense, this would be kind of, instead of marking the object, we would by that kind of get the forward address at that place. Okay. This would be, makes the, now, yeah, the forward address at that place. Okay, and now, so once the copying has completed, all in the heap, in the two space, we have only live objects, and all the references there go to the from space and refer to these dummy references. Yeah? So, and go to these forward references in the from space. So it would be like that. Then we kind of move over the objects in the two space, and all the references in the two space go to this dummy things in the from space. Okay? And now we simply traverse the list, the objects in the two space, the A, B, the A, C, D, and then see the references there, and then replace these references to correct the references, because we just follow these things here. This A, for example, we see, oh, this points to that, So we can so we can write this reference there. Yeah? So we look it up and do the correction. And so that means in the last phase we just traverse the two space and correct all the references, but still there this is a little bit of a passing problem. We have to see what are the tags and what are the references in the objects and how large are the objects. So but if this kind of organizational cell here, this cell here down there, if this cell, I want to make it in red. This information here, if this contains information about the layout, so for example, it says, okay, the name of this, here is the name and of the object, or the type of the object, and it contains 5 references. Then I have to count for 5, and the next 5 things are the references which I have to correct, and then the next object starts. So by that I can pass if every object in this sense is self-describing, I can do this garbage collection. I can pass the two space and correct all the references. And again, so then all the references in the end have been corrected, and then the collection is terminated, and I can exchange from space and to space, and program execution can continue. Yeah. Okay, so that was here, and one more thing. So I said this marking and this copying can be joined together in a single phase, where the marking, in some sense, is leaving the forward references in the from space. Yeah, by that kind of, at least we do not have 3 traversals, but only now 2 traversals, namely 1 traversal to do the copying and marking, and 1 traversal to do the correction of the references. Now, even that, since garbage collection is an expensive operation, people try to optimize that as much as possible. So they try even to do it in such a way that they try to kind of avoid to optimize the second traversal by trying to correct as many references on the fly as possible. And so do not always do this forwarding of references, but correct the references already during the copying, whenever possible. So that kind of might help to do it essentially, to do the copying and essentially in one pass. Only some references will not be possible because an object has not yet been moved. So because these are references to something which not yet has been moved, and therefore we do not yet know the references, the real address. And these kind of references then have to be recorded, and then you only have to correct these in the end. And that also would mean, if one wants to kind of do the correction of the references in the directly at the same in the same path, in the same pass, that means you can also do not the DFS. You can do a DFS traversal, yes, as we did it here, but you cannot do it in a pre-order, but you have to do it in a post-order thing, so that you first collect those which are reachable from you, and only once they have already been moved to the two space, then you move also your current object to the two space. Yeah. So in that sense, you see there, when I try to explain that to you, that there are it seems conceptually it's always the same. These 3 tasks have to be satisfied, but have to be accomplished. But the question is how to organize it in detail so that you spend as little effort as possible. And here constant factors matter. So it's not so that, okay, three passes, this is not more expensive than one pass. Yes, it is more expensive, and you do not want to spend these three passes. You want to spend much as little as possible. Okay, and there's one more thing. So do you know what in real garbage collectors, what kind of extra trick they play for real garbage collectors? So here I have it kind of explained it to you as if the full heap is collected at every garbage collection time. But that is not in real life collectors. In real life collectors, what do they do? Who has ever implemented a garbage collector? No one. Who has ever looked at a garbage collector? Also no one. So then it might be a useful thing to know this, so they have an idea which is a generational garbage collection. So they follow the philosophy, young people die young, old live forever. Yeah, so that is, they distinguish between two generations, the old ones and the new ones, and the new ones are more often, frequently collected, and the old ones are only collected now and then. And that has a big advantage because you have the little collections where you have only inspect a small portion of your memory, and experience shows that there's particularly in functional programming, a lot of objects which just intermediately are constructed for a few and then thrown away immediately. And these can be then rapidly recollected. And other things like that a full tree is, which has been worked on heavily, then is going to garbage. This happens, yes, but it happens less frequent. And so these are the old guys, which sadly enough live forever. The old boars, which live forever. Okay. So these are this generational thing. This is kind of more or less state of the art, what languages like OCaml do. Okay, now for the Vim, it is a little bit more complicated. So there we could use in principle something like a similar garbage collection, but we must recall that we have two kinds of garbage collection, namely the positive one, and so which we would like to run even if there's no backtracking, and the negative one which we use for backtracking, and these two kind of garbage collections must somehow be harmonized. That means the garbage collection in the negative case, this was popping the heap. So this means when we do the copying, we should copy in such a way that the ordering of the heap objects is not changed. Because we would like to pop, and that means really the stack discipline should be preserved. Okay, and that means also that when we correct the heap addresses, we also must update the trail addresses. And so that means we have to, and also the heap pointers have to be updated. Because the heap pointers point the heap, so if this here is my famous fabulous heap, so, and here are kind of the different segments of the heap which the heap pointers point to, and I do a collection which kind of compresses this heap a little bit, then clearly I have to adjust the heap pointers. Okay, so now let us see how we can do this this garbage collection by means of which preserves the ordering in the stack. So this means in the first case we do the markings, this is the same, and in the second case we do the copying, but we copy kind of now in by traversing the so I have no explanation for that. Is there an explanation? So the copying is more expensive in that I kind of do not only have to follow the references for the copying, but kind of have to traverse the from space in a bottom-up way to kind of, when I see a live object, I copy it, and then I proceed. So this means, in this sense, it is the traversal, the cost of garbage collection is proportional to the cost of all objects, and not only proportional to the live objects. This, therefore, garbage collection for the Vim is more expensive than for the Mama. Yeah. Okay. So that would be the story for the garbage for the declarative languages such as OCaml and Prolog. And we would now, so is there a question to that? Because that would be now the moment to ask. Otherwise, then we would now proceed to two further topics, and the first to see what does it mean to have classes and objects, and the second topic would be what does it mean to have threads. So for the, I'm not so sure whether we will make it into the threads, but at least for the classes and objects, this we will have enough time to look at. So now the question is, what kind of language should we choose? What kind of object-oriented language? So there are many object-oriented languages. A natural choice with your background might be to choose Java, but that is a little bit different because difficult, because there I could not easily reuse the C machine. I would have kind of to modify the C machine in order to deal with Java peculiarities. So therefore, I decided to use something like a Pidgin C++, which I can, so that the object-oriented extension is just built on top of C, or at least of this fragment of C which we have seen. And it is also a little bit instructive, perhaps for those of you who are at least a little bit familiar with C++, but that you learn a little bit more about it. Who has programmed in C++? Everybody? Who has not programmed in C++? Have you seen a little bit C++ somewhere? Or so the key point here is, so here is a list class. And I hope it is not too stupid. Now what is the point of object oriented programming? So that you have a notion of a class, and at least in C++, this class concept is somehow related to the concept of a struct. So there's not so big a difference between a struct and a class. So the class declaration provides us with a declaration of fields with their types. So here is two kind of fields, and additionally there are extra, you might call it fields or members inside this struct, which are methods which you can call to operate on the objects of this class. So this is the same as we have in Java. The only big difference is that a class in itself is really should be understood as a struct, and a struct can also live unboxed directly on the stack. And the variable can take the value of such a, can have a struct value. While in Java, a variable has always the type reference to the struct which lives in the heap. The struct in C++ is, so the object in C++ is something which is just a block of memory containing fields. Yeah, so that is the key difference. And okay, and the other thing is that if you write a method in there, then the default is that this method is static. So it's not static. So it is that the method is the method is selected according to the static type of the variable. While if you want to have it in a way that that the class hierarchy matters, and then you would have to explicitly mention that and mark the method as virtual. So that is a key difference to Java. So the default is that functions, that methods are non-virtual, while the default in Java is that methods are virtual. So that makes a big difference. Okay, and those are, and those functions which are, okay. So that is this thing here, and you also have, you might have constructors. So here's a list constructor. A list constructor where you kind of initialize, which you may call with a new. So this is similar to Java, which allows you to initialize an object which is created. Okay. So now what is, so here this is a unary list constructor, which a list constructor with only one element, and that will return a one element list, where the next field will be a null pointer in this example. Okay, so what else? And then this virtual function which I have provided here is an implementation of a function last, which kind of traverses a list, is called for a list object, and then checks whether the next reference is null, and then the content of the current list object is returned, and otherwise the next element is accessed, and last is called for the next element. Yeah. So this is here my little example implementation of a small class list, and you see here there is one more thing. I have provided us with a global variable count, which is used to count the number of objects for which this constructor here is called. So it's just a global variable because it is a superset of C. We have globals, so we can use such. We just write count and then we have it. So that's it. Okay. And there's perhaps one extra, perhaps more extra things, but one in our little toy language or in our toy examples, we will not care about things like private, public, protected, and such things, because they do not matter for code generation, because these are kind of protective or restriction. They restrict the use of something, but do not affect the implementation. By that, you can reject certain uses of a of a method or uses of a field or so, but once this is checked by the static by the static semantics of the compiler, when it comes to code generation, then you have a program which you arrive there only with programs which respect these kind of restrictions, and then you generate code. So therefore, for our purposes, we can simply ignore them and consider programs which do not have these restrictions. So therefore, you do not find things like private or public or something or whatnot in the code. Okay, so this kind of, so that by that we have explained to you this little, this little example, and we continue with this C++ language then in the next week. Thank you very much for today.